The second matter for oral argument this morning is a consolidation of two appeals. The first one is number 24491, with Cheryl Jacobson being the appellant, Kevin Leisinger being the appellee. The second one is 24492 and 98. And this one, Mr. Leisinger is the appellant, and Ms. Jacobson is the appellee. For Ms. Jacobson, we have Patricia Myers, an attorney from Rapid City. And for Mr. Leisinger, we have David Hosmer, an attorney from Yankton. Because we have different appellants in the two cases, the court is going to split the time. The first case will allow 10 minutes for the appellant, 10 minutes for the appellee, and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Same for the second case. So, court should also know that Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself on this matter, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, a former justice of this court, to sit in Justice Meyer Henry's place. With that, Ms. Myers, you may proceed on 24491, and you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. This case started with the reversal by this court of a punitive damage award in a case called Leisinger versus Jacobson, found at 651 Northwest 2nd, 693. That was a malicious prosecution case brought by Mr. Leisinger against his former wife, in which the jury had awarded punitive damages in the amount of $120,000. This court found that award excessive and reversed and remanded, giving Mr. Leisinger the opportunity to either accept a remittitor to $25,000 or to have a new trial on the issue of punitive damages. Mr. Leisinger opted for his right to have a new trial, and that's where this case begins. From that point until 2006, when Mr. Leisinger finally paid the $120,000 back, the judgment on punitive damages was vacated. It was of no more. Every attorney fee incurred between the reversal by this court in 2002 in the Leisinger versus Jacobson case on the $120,000 until Mr. Leisinger paid that amount of money at the end of all of his appeals in Leisinger versus Jacobson, 651 Northwest 2nd, were incurred in connection with simply the recovery of a judgment that was no longer in existence. The trial court, or the Supreme Court, vacated the punitive damage judgment. I had to go to Judge Severson to get an order on remand setting forth that the judgment was vacated and that Mr. Leisinger was required to repay it along with interest at 15%. Mr. Leisinger has never, ever appealed the fact that the $120,000 was due and owing to Mrs. Jacobson at that point. He's never appealed that. He's had four other appeals of that case, the underlying litigation, but never of that fact. The first appeal was of the fact of the 15% interest assessed by the court. Then Mr. Leisinger missed his time to apply for a new trial and to try the case, the punitive damage case, again. When the court granted my motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution under the statute, Mr. Leisinger appealed that. Then I attempted to enforce the judgment of the court and the order of the court requiring Mr. Leisinger to repay the $120,000 through contempt proceedings. Mr. Leisinger avoided process. I then moved the court to correct or amend the order to call it a judgment so that I could have execution issued on the judgment, and Mr. Leisinger objected to that and then appealed that order and appealed again the interest awarded by the court on that order, or subsequently the judgment. It was only at that point when Mr. Leisinger told the court at that point, I have converted this $120,000 into a piece of property. I would like to deposit that property with the trial court to stay execution of the judgment. The court refused to allow him to do that, and only at that point did Mr. Leisinger finally deposit $120,000, the principal amount of the judgment, plus a small amount of interest with the trial court, while his last appeal proceeded in front of this court. Once that appeal was summarily affirmed, as all the previous appeals had been, Then that amount was paid over to Ms. Jacobson. In the meantime, I started this conversion action in 2003 to try to recover not only the $120,000 to somehow get the money she was entitled to, but also to pursue her damages that arose from, in fact, her pursuit of those monies that she was lawfully entitled to, that Mr. Leasinger himself has never disputed that she's lawfully entitled to.
Well,
Schultes versus Miller, and I think that's the issue in this case, is clearly distinguishable. In both Schultes versus Miller and every case cited by the plaintiff in the conversion claim, in Schultes versus Miller, they sought their attorney's fees for pursuing that claim. I have never done that. I have sought only those attorney's fees that I have incurred on Mrs. Jacobson's behalf in attempting to recover the $120,000 this court said she was entitled to once that judgment wasn't vacated. All of those proceedings, I have never, ever attempted to recover any damages.
You call it a conversion action, but really what you're seeking is an action on a judgment. You're seeking to enforce the judgment. Is that what you're saying?
I have enforced the judgment in the underlying proceeding. So I'm seeking the fees that were incurred in obtaining and enforcing the judgment in the underlying proceeding in the conversion claim. That's right.
So I'm trying to maybe simplify this. I take your treatise on torts, and I don't return it. You sue me. You get an order or a judgment saying I have to return it. I don't. And so now you're entitled to sue me to recover not just for the treatise, but also for your fees in trying to recover the treatise after you get the judgment. So this is a little bit of a different animal than Schultes in the sense that now you have a judgment, and the judgment is not being complied with.
Exactly. Exactly. That's in Schultes, as in the other cases cited by the plaintiff, in each case they were seeking their fees for obtaining the judgment of conversion. Here, Mr. Leasinger has always acknowledged he owed her the money. He owed her the $120,000. He had 1,000 reasons why he didn't think he should have to pay her that.
Did the court ever find him in contempt?
The court did not find him in contempt, Your Honor, because I had filed an order to show cause. I had attempted to serve Mr. Leasinger. Mr. Leasinger avoided service of process. The court found that he avoided service of process because his girlfriend showed up at the hearing, but he did not, and Mr. Hosmer appeared only by telephone. At that point, I moved to ask the judge to call the order a judgment so I could get an execution issued because I was spending more money trying to find him to have him held in contempt than I thought it was probably worth to pursue the typical execution. And the clerks, for some reason, wouldn't consider the order a judgment, so they wouldn't issue an execution simply on the order. We had a little brief about that, too. So we briefed practically every issue that could be briefed in this case in the underlying proceedings. In these proceedings, the conversion action itself, the court found as a matter of law early on that the conversion had occurred. So the only issue that happened or that remained then were the amount of damages. After a short jury trial on that issue, the judge found as a matter of law that under Schultes versus Miller, I could not sustain that claim because her only damages were the attorney fees incurred in the underlying proceedings. What we had argued and what we continue to argue is that under the Christians case particularly, this court, there is authority for the fact that attorney fees can be pursued for obtaining execution on the judgment in the underlying action, conversion action, and pursuing those fees in a separate proceeding. It looked like you were going to ask me a question, Justice Gilbertson, so I didn't want to interrupt.
No.
Okay.
Well, Judge Teedy read Schultes as requiring or prohibiting both recovery or fees for pursuing the property and in the litigation. And I know in Schultes we said no attorney fees, we leave it to the legislature. Where did Judge Teedy get it wrong?
Well, in Schultes versus Miller, I think because the 21-3-3 subparagraph 3 talks about fair compensation in the pursuit of the recovery of property. And in Schuldes versus Miller, the court recognized that, but then said that because that statute isn't specific enough to give you fees in the conversion action, then we're not going to do that, and we're going to leave that to the legislature. But what Schuldes versus Miller did not say is that fees incurred in another action to recover the property itself were prohibited. And the previous case out of this court in Christians clearly did provide for fees for the recovery of property on an execution in an underlying action, or actually a different action completely. So I think that's where Judge Tiede got it wrong, is he continues to look at Schuldes in just that narrow context of a conversion action. If the fees arise in a conversion action, wherever that action arises for the recovery of the property without a specific statute allowing recovery for attorney fees, fair compensation under our statute 21-3-3 subparent freed 3 does not include attorney fees without a specific statute or explanation. The things that the statute did allow and were described as allowing were things that I essentially did as an attorney. The client could have done, obtaining execution, serving process on Mr. Leasinger to have him held in or attempting to serve process on Mr. Leasinger.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 10 minutes, Mr. Osmer.
Thank you. It pleases the court and counsel. I, too, would like to talk about all the problems that I've had as a result of my client in this case, too. But let's talk about the issue, and that's whether or not Judge Tiede got it wrong. And really, the issue is whether or not Schuldes is an important case and relevant, and also looking at the statute itself. Let's look at the statute, which is the first place that we should look at. This is a conversion lawsuit, nothing else. Conversion is the cause of action. That's why I went to trial, was on the complaint for conversion. 21-3-3 actually identifies three types of damages. The A and B are actually in the alternative, depending upon whether you don't get the property back, and then if you do get the property back under Section C, you can then get fair time and some out-of-pocket expenses. Now, Schuldes said very clearly that if your damages are attorney fees in the underlying conversion lawsuit, the one that you're suing at trial, you can't get them. Now, we believe Justice Konenkamp wrote the decision, as Justice Sabers had a concurring opinion discussing some of that consequence. Let's look at the statute first. There's no mention of attorney fees, okay? The whole court acknowledged that. You know, if you're going to look at a statute and acknowledge that attorney fees should be awarded, they should be specific. It's not a liberal construction of statutes as it relates to attorney fees. It may be a liberal construction of statutes on other things, but it's not for attorney fees. And, in fact, the American rule is that a narrow construction, if it's not by statute, then it has to be by contract. No contract here. There wasn't in Schuldes. So then they looked at the statute. The court did, pardon me. Once you look at that statute, I think you also have to look at what has the legislature done for attorney fees elsewhere. It's very clear. They have done it multiple times, said, look, we can award attorney fees, and we'll put it by statute. We'll identify it. Condemnation under 21-3523. Nuisance action, 21-10-25.6. If the legislature wants to do it, they will. And, Justice Konenkamp, your point is well taken. Schuldes has decided many years ago, nothing's been done by the legislature since. As a result, one can conclude that the court, allowing the legislature to take action, they chose not to take action. Why? Because there's a specific statute on attorney fees. That's why. You know, what Ms. Jacobson really wants to do is make up for the fact that she couldn't get attorney fees in the other action by suing in this action. And, you know, there's just no statutory authority for it. And Schuldes doesn't say that you can recover attorney fees in the underlying other action, but I think that it's broad enough to cover it for these reasons. Number one, go back to the statute again. 21-3-3 makes no mention of any attorney fees, including another action. Number two, the same bases for Schuldes apply for this. This court relied upon the American rule. how can the American rule for attorney fees apply differently for the underlying conversion action as opposed to those in the malicious prosecution action?
Isn't it because it's an element of damage rather than recovery of fees?
Well, if you're talking about malicious prosecution, for example, that was one of the bases for making the argument for Ms. Jacobson here. That is an element, for example, in a malicious prosecution case. You have to prove the attorney fees in order to prove that you'd actually been in court. And it's one of the elements. With all due respect to Mr. Justice Saber's opinion, I think that's why malicious prosecution attorney fees are allowed. In addition, there's more flexibility there. Let's be honest here. When it came to the elements of malicious prosecution, it was a common law crime. This court had a little bit more leeway there. When it came to the conversion statute for damages, the legislature interceded and made a statement. This is what we'd like to do. Now, I understand it's been this court's opinion in the past that you will defer to what the legislature says on these instances. Now, I understand that there's been a suggestion that the Christensen case applies here. We disagree with the Christensen case applying. First of all, it doesn't say anything about attorney fees. Second of all, it was decided prior to Schultes, so if it was that important, you would have thought this court would have relied upon it. And in order to get their decision on Christensen, they have to then go one step further and say, yeah, but Christensen was interpreted through the framework of Kirby Kerr, a divorce action. If this court really wants to state an opinion and precedent about awarding attorney fees for damages in a conversion action, I hardly think that it would be the appropriate manner of doing so by doing through two different cases, one of which was a divorce action. But Christensen really only decided this, and you go back to that holding. There was sufficient evidence in the record to affirm those particular damages, whatever they were. In fact, this court didn't even identify what they were because they weren't important. The issue wasn't before him. I would like to mention one other case that was not in my brief or in the brief of Ms. Jacobson. And that case is Wrench v. Riddle's Jewelry, which is cited at 393 Northwest 2nd 269.
You say it's not in either brief?
No, it's not. I reviewed this as a result of looking at their brief. I didn't have an opportunity.
Right. Under our court rules, then, you have to furnish, Shirley, how many copies?
The original 14.
Oof-da. I'll ignore that one. Just
I guess you can withdraw it if you want.
I don't have my back pocket. If you'd like, I'll tell you what. I'll provide them. I think it's important.
All right. For the court. Well, send us 15 copies then and continue on.
Thank you. The Wrench case was a conversion lawsuit. It's in the notes for the conversion statutes. What happened in that particular case was is that Riddles argued that the trial court should have adopted a restatement 222 regarding the definition of conversion. They appealed that decision, and this court said to the trial court was correct in ignoring the definition of conversion. And the reason that it was correct in ignoring it was simply because this court had created a lot of case law regarding conversion, which was opposite that of the restatement. Now, the significance of that is this. When someone comes before this court and makes an argument that some type of other restatement should be adopted, which they've done in two instances here, 927 and 914, to support their case, it can't be opposite of what the common law is here. You can expand upon the definition, but you can't expand upon what's available. So, and I guess I should have prefaced that by saying that there were two other instances that they asked for methods for obtaining attorney fees here, one of which was Restatement 927, and the other was Restatement 914. 927 mentions nothing of attorney fees. It says nothing about whether or not anybody can do it. In fact, if you look at it, it talks about pecuniary loss and then defines and suggests that you go elsewhere, our Restatement 914, which is specific to attorney fees. But in that one, 914 doesn't apply either because that is the tort of another. And I will just briefly explain, we don't think that's applicable either. Now, in this particular case, the tort of another case, the court in Grand State Property versus Woods Fuller, which was a malpractice action, made reference to the fact that in malpractice actions, you can occasionally recover attorney fees. Now, that again is another exception because in order to do that, you have to try the case within the case. In order to do that, you have to, it's kind of like malicious prosecution. You have the case previous and then this case. And this court said, okay, we can get some attorney fees there. And they said, but it has to be in an unrelated third-party action. There's no unrelated third-party action here. The malicious prosecution had the same parties. The conversion suit had the same parties. So even that, if the court were to adopt it, is not applicable.
We have a situation here where the court has ruled that Mr. Leisinger has to pay back the amount of money that we're talking about. That's converted to a judgment, right?
It was converted.
Now, why isn't, from that point on, why isn't the only remedy that's necessary to take is an execution on, or a levy on the judgment?
Well, that certainly was an option. In this particular case, what happened is that's the underlying malicious prosecution case. We dispute the fact that it was, that he avoided process for the order to show cause. It was converted to a judgment, which we appealed. This court denied the appeal.
All right, so there's a judgment.
Yes.
So why should there be any remedy or any further lawsuit other than a levy or an execution on the judgment?
Well, I hate to say this, but it's due to my incompetence that that issue is not before this court. I did file a notice of review on that issue, but unfortunately, I filed it too late. That was an issue that I briefed before the court, and it was denied by Judge Keene, but I would have brought it before the court. It's not before the court, but I do believe that you're right. I don't think that this conversion action should have proceeded.
You've never raised that as a defense?
I did. I even briefed it. The unfortunate thing is I didn't get it to this court by way of a notice of review.
Your time has expired, Mr. Osmer. Thank you. You have 5 minutes, Ms. Myers.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Same questions for you, Ms. Myers. Why wasn't your sole remedy at the time that you have a judgment for a certain amount of money to levy and execute on that judgment, go to the sheriff with a levy and an execution and try and find some property in the county that you can sell for the purposes of satisfying that judgment?
Your Honor, if this had been your typical conversion claim, where the defendant had taken the property under an initial claim of right and then held on to the property and I got a judgment saying, give me back the property, I would agree. Because of the way this claim came about, where the judgment, essentially the punitive damage judgment, was vacated, so there was no judgment. But Mr. Leisinger had
you converted that to a judgment. So
but
from that point on, why isn't levy and execution your sole remedy?
Because the steps I had to take to obtain property that was lawfully hers at the point that this court, that Mr. Leisinger refused the remitter and that judgment was vacated, at that point, every step I had to take from that point to getting a judgment entered for the $120,000 so that I could execute on it were items of damage, because I didn't have a judgment. I had a vacated judgment. He had the property. He's never disputed that that judgment was no longer in existence, but I've had to go through three different appeals on issues. He's used the legal process essentially to avoid paying back money he knew he had to pay back. And that's the difference here. And that's the difference between Schultes versus Miller and every other case. We aren't asking you to find attorney's fees as a cost in the conversion claim itself. The trial court found that the conversion occurred as a matter of law. So what I'm seeking is those attorney fees that just got me from where I had nothing, not even an order. I got an order on remand. I attempted to enforce that order through the appropriate process on a contempt proceeding. I attempted to get an execution. The clerk wouldn't give me one, so I had to try to convert it to a judgment. All
How
of those things then were appealed.
That? How long ago did you convert it to a judgment?
It was converted to a judgment in 2005. That's when Mr. Leisinger deposited the money into the court.
Once you have that, then why do you need further lawsuits to levy and execute on that judgment?
that, well, at that point, we'd had three prior appeals getting to that point, just to that point. So that's the only fees, those are the only fees I'm seeking in this action. And Mr. Leisinger has agreed.
All prior to 2002?
All prior to 2005, when it was finally reduced to a judgment. And Mr. Leisinger has agreed that I'm only seeking those fees. And unfortunately, it's close to $30,000 now because of the way Mr. Leisinger has used the judicial process to block payment of monies he has always acknowledged Mrs. Leisinger is entitled to. So that's the basic difference between Schultes versus Miller and this claim, is that the court and Mr. Leisinger have always acknowledged that she was entitled to those funds, but she has incurred these damages in trying to simply obtain a judgment she could enforce. And she's been damaged and not made whole in that regard, and that's why we're asking you for that opportunity. I had an expert witness. We were prepared to go forward in front of the jury. The court would not allow that testimony to prove the damages that were related to each action that I took to obtain that judgment and ultimately enforce that judgment. And so I do have a judgment now. The judgment has been paid to the extent of $125,000. There remains some interest that has not been paid, and I am pursuing that in that context as an execution. So unless I don't have any further presentation, unless the court has any other questions for me. Thank you for your time.
All right, now we'll proceed to appeal 24492. In this one, Mr. Leisinger is the appellant, and therefore, Mr. Hosmer, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, round four. I have appealed, pursuant to a decision of Judge Keene, that my client did not timely file a defamation lawsuit. What happened in this particular case is that immediately after the malicious prosecution lawsuit ended, within 48 hours, there was a phone call made to 911 dispatch in Minnehaha County, and they responded to Cheryl Jacobson's house. Cheryl Jacobson, that being Kevin's ex-wife. When they arrived, they couldn't find her. They searched for her, and literally, they had everybody in the county looking for this woman. She was found about 120 yards from her house in a field, complaining that she'd been assaulted. And she told Detective Balfe, who was a Minnehaha County Sheriff's deputy, that she had been assaulted and that Kevin did it. And
didn't she say she wasn't sure? She thought he was involved, or something like that.
I believe her exact language was, "I can't prove it, but I think that he's. I think he did it." Which,
what year was that?
That would have been May 21st, 2001.
Okay. And when did you bring your suit?
The counterclaim was filed on December 11th, 2003.
Okay.
She also told Brooke Templeton on two instances in her victim's compensation report in August and September, I believe, of 2001, that she also believed that Kevin had done this as well. I'm going to skip the fact that I think this is defamatory because he completely denies that it occurred. He says that he had nothing to do with this whatsoever. In fact, there's the evidence in those reports that you have from Detective Balfe indicating they were actually investigating Cheryl for purposes of a false reporting claim, but she was never prosecuted for whatever reason. The real issue in this case, as Judge Keene decided, was at what date does the statute of limitations begin, number one, and number two, what date does it end? Is there an accrual at the end, an additional time at the end due to the fact that it was filed as a counterclaim and it relates back? First issue, our perception is this is governed by the interpretation of Strasburg, which I believe was an opinion by Mr. Justice Konenkamp, and then also its interpretation cases of Wissink and Huron Central. In all three of those cases, there was an issue of when the statute of limitations began. This court interpreted the word accrued in those statutes, 15213, 14 and 15, and said that accrual begins upon actual discovery or constructive discovery, which was defined in two statutes, 17.1.2 and 17.1.3. Now, you just heard who I said that she told this to, a deputy sheriff, and also to Brooke Templeton, the victim's comp. Both are subject to statutory obligations to not tell anybody. As a result, my client didn't even know about those particular publications until considerably later. There are three sources, and we have a factual dispute here. That's the real issue that we've always stated throughout the entire time. According to Cooper v. James, we have a factual dispute on when this arose. I would like to address the statements made by Kevin, or what his knowledge was of in 2001. There are three sources. Number one, he hired as an off-duty deputy sheriff Pat Adams. You should note that he has the same first name as opposing counsel. It's interesting. I'll bring it up as it relates to what he disclosed at the deposition. Pat Adams said, look, keep your eyes up, basically, watch out, and told him a few brief facts about what the place looked like. And Kevin was like, what are you talking about? I never got interviewed. I have no clue what's going on. He was curious, but that's all he knew. He didn't even know that she'd made any statement, didn't even know there was a call to 911, nothing. After that, he lived near where Cheryl lived and ran into one of Cheryl's ex-tenants by the name of Megan Parr. We can't find Megan Parr. But nevertheless, he claims that Megan Parr confirmed what the officer said and also said a few other things. She painted her living room red as the some color that she was infatuated with. And there were police cars and officers' cars and sheriff's cars and everybody under the sun looking for this woman. Now he's really curious. On December 10th of 2001, he went to the sheriff's department to try and get the blotter to find out exactly what happened. Were there all these people there or not? Assistant Sheriff Swan said, we're not giving that to you. You're not getting it. Immediately, Kevin thought, I'll be very candid, Kevin Leisinger's had a lot of problems with law enforcement over the years as it relates to he and his ex-wife. I believe this court had an appeal concerning a protection order case with him. He's had a number of appeals. And he didn't trust them. And as soon as they said that, he knew something was up. So it's our position that at that point in time, at the very most, he had constructive notice that something was going on. We still believe, to be very honest with you, that he didn't have actual notice until a month and a half later, after he filed the actual counterclaim. I know you're thinking, how can you file a counterclaim but not have notice of it? And the answer is, look at the counterclaim. We allege six causes of action. It was the shotgun counterclaim of all time, for the simple reason that we didn't know. And, you know, I'm not proud of it, but that's what my client wanted to do, and he wanted it done. So I did it. So we filed as a counterclaim. Now, at his deposition, you know, Ms. Jacobson obviously makes note of the fact that, look, he started talking about this in his deposition. Let me give you some background. At this deposition, we're starting to talk about what was under a protective order from a civil rights lawsuit filed against Minnehaha County, of which I got all the documents that I'm talking about from Deputy Balfe and also from Victims Comp. And at that particular time, we're having a four-way conversation between Bill Beck, myself, Pat Myers, and Kevin Leisinger. Please read that state transcript again. All it says is that he knew in 2001 what happened. It doesn't say when. And he's talking about Pat Adams. He's addressing Pat Myers. After that, this is what happened. We went back to the court because a summary judgment was filed upon one of the causes of act or multiple causes of action. Judge Keene looked us in the face and said, counsel, when did you know about this, the cause of action? Kevin said, I don't know. And he said, well, if you don't know when it started, you haven't pled it appropriately, and I'm going to kick it. So I said, all right, we're going to have to figure out when this was. So we started digging, and that's when we found the interrogatory answers from January of 2002, which indicated that Kevin went to Deputy Swan's office on December 10th, 2001. Sorry for all the convoluted facts here, but it is important. And so December 10th of 2001, we know for a fact. That's all we know. That's all Kevin knows. He knows that he found out in 2001. He thinks he found out from Pat Adams something before that, but he knows that he went to the sheriff's office on December 10th, and then because of what Megan Parr said. There's nothing inconsistent about that. Cheryl Jacobson thinks that somehow there's something nefarious for trying to pull something over on the court. No, there's nothing. We were responding to Judge Keene's statement that we had to put something on the record. Now, what I've done is basically said this. It's December 10th, 2001 is the date of constructive notice. At 2 years, That's December 10th, 2003. I filed the counterclaim December 11th, 2003, one day late, according to the actual rules. Our position is that by when it was filed, it relates back. Now, I know the court is saying, how does that relate back?
Well, I want to make sure I understand.
Yes.
Are you agreeing then that it was filed one day late?
I'm conceding that it was filed on that date. I'm not conceding that my cause of action is barred by the statute of limitations.
No, but you said it was filed one day late.
If you don't take into consideration the other two statutes, sure. Yeah. If this court says those other statutes are relevant, I'm out of luck. So, but we don't think we're out of luck. And the reason we don't think we're out of luck is because of the rules of relation back. You know, I'm going to have to give you 15 copies of something else, too. Actually, I found it to be an interesting case. I'll do it, too. It's the McDonald case. It's a case from Alaska in which basically it was a counterclaim for defamation against this woman for basically a false report of a claim against her. It's an interesting case. I think it substantiates it. I also think that when this... Their argument is that it doesn't relate back because it was not a compulsory counterclaim. It was a permissive counterclaim. But our argument in response to that is that we think they've waived it. And the simple reason is that because they never objected to it being a permissive counterclaim in the first place. The statute says to be a permissive counterclaim, it has to be, you can object if it's unrelated to the subject matter. They never filed a motion claiming it was unrelated to the subject matter. As a result, they've conceded it. And that's the test, by the way, as it relates to substantial relationship for... Excuse me, I'm done.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hosmer. Ms. Myers, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. I'm not clear on his argument on the mandatory counterclaim and the permissive counterclaim, so I will leave it at my argument that... this was not a mandatory counterclaim. I don't think I waived or conceded anything by not raising it as a permissive counterclaim with regard to the statute of limitations issue, and it cannot relate back. Mr. Leisinger's own words are what give Mr. Leisinger's claim or leave Mr. Leisinger without a claim. It was nothing of Cheryl Jacobson's. It is solely Mr. Leisinger's own testimony on three different occasions, which confirmed for the trial court that he had notice, actual and constructive notice, of any type of defamation claim well before December 10th of 2003, and therefore his claim was simply barred by the two-year statute of limitations on slander and defamation. Mr. Leisinger's own statements at his deposition, his first affidavit that was filed, I believe, on August of 2005, and then a second amended affidavit after Judge Keene did in fact question him concerning the statute of limitations, all suggest that Mr. Leisinger not only knew that there were these allegations out there, but had actual notice of those through Pat Adams at a minimum, and his own investigation. He may have confirmed what he believed when he received documents through his 1984 proceedings against the city. But he clearly, through his own testimony, had knowledge of those issues prior to that time. The second issue, which we raised by a notice of review, if this court should find somehow that his claim relates back or that he didn't have notice, despite his own words saying he did have notice prior to the 2 years statute of limitations, is that any statements made by Ms. Jacobson were all made in the context of an official proceeding and are unqualified. They are unqualifiedly privileged and unconditionally privileged under 20-5-11. And for that reason, then, any claim that he could make would be barred. The trial court did not reach that issue because it did not need to, finding that his claim was rather barred by the statute of limitations. But in fact, the statement made by Ms. Jacobson was in fact made in response to a question posed to her by Deputy Balfe, or Balfe, I'm not sure exactly how she pronounces her name. Ms. Jacobson did not accuse Mr. Leisinger and has never accused Mr. Leisinger of assaulting her on this May 2001 occasion. She answered in response to a question posed to her at the hospital by Deputy Balfe, "Do you think Kevin Leisinger did it?" She said, "I don't have any proof, but yes, I think he did it. Yes, this has been a long and contentious case arising from a divorce and a protection order. Yes, this did occur on the heels of the malicious prosecution case." But Ms. Jacobson responded to a question posed to her and did not make a statement in any other context other than to Agent or to Deputy Balfe in response to her question. Her subsequent statements with regard to Ms. Templeton in her pursuit of her claim for victim's compensation were equally vague and nonspecific. She believed she had been assaulted. She believed that the police had not done a sufficient job of investigating that case, and she raised those issues with the victim's compensation, but again in that official investigatory capacity, and thus those any statements thus made were privileged for that reason. Unless the court has some questions for me, again, I have no other presentation for the court on these issues because I think the issues are extremely clear. Certainly, the claims raised by Mr. Leisinger in his counterclaim were many and varied and arose from all of these underlying proceedings, and this has been a long and difficult case for both these parties.
How do you respond to Mr. Hosmer's argument that the deposition does not say when in 2001 this occurred and that the interrogatory really just relates back to the meeting with the deputy?
Well, I think if you read that deposition testimony, he had his lawyer telling him what to say. He had the opportunity to talk to his lawyer. His testimony to me is clear. Pat told him. He's not talking about me. He's looking at me, and he's not talking about me because he knows I haven't told him anything. He's telling me Pat told him. He knows Pat Adams. But the more telling, really, statements are his statements in his first affidavit, which he then subsequently amended when I made my first motion for summary judgment on his other five claims. His first affidavit clearly sets forth that he knew about this supposed defamation as early as summer of 2001, and he simply cannot get around that. Those are words from his mouth. And he has to have personal knowledge of what he puts in an affidavit and swears to under oath. He also had the opportunity to read and sign his deposition, and he didn't correct any of this until after the question was raised by Judge Keene. And I think Judge Keene summed it up very clearly in his opinion on the issue to us, where he states that Mr. Leisinger's testimony on this issue is I think the kindest word he used was obfuscation. So with that, I would, unless there's anything further in my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Myers. You have 5 minutes, Mr. Hosmer.
Never seems to be enough. Thank you. Just to go back to what your point is, I was not intending to give any instruction to this to my client during the deposition. And, in fact, Mr. Beck is standing behind me as a representative of Minnehaha County making sure that I'm not violating a protection order. Subsequent to that, we entered into a protection order, and then we could discuss exactly what the contents of it were. When this deposition was taken, we did have the officer's reports and everything that we could talk about. I had them, but she didn't. So that's why you see multiple conversations. There's no dates, none. All he knows is 2001. Still doesn't know to this day.
Well, he knew in the summer of 2001.
I disagree with that, too. From my understanding of it is, he said in his second affidavit sometime in 2001. And that's really all it can come down to. The only thing, we know a chronology. We know you heard sometime from Pat Adams sometime in 2001. And we think we're pretty sure it was before Megan Parr. But again, so what? The question then becomes, what's the content of it? You know, is there sufficient facts? you, just because you have notice of the fact that someone says, watch out, be on guard, that's not enough notice of what the facts are to allude to something to say that that's defamatory. What he heard from Pat Adams was watch your back. And he told him the facts about seeing stuff in the garage, which were really, really weird, and that's it. How can anybody interpret the fact that that's defamatory? It's not. I would like the opportunity to address the privilege. I don't think that either one of the statutes that they rely upon, the sections, are applicable here. First of all, as it relates to Detective Balfe, the vast majority of states, the vast majority, as I've cited there, say that if statements to law enforcement reporting crime are qualifiedly privileged. Second of all, this court has held indirectly in the Keyser case versus Southeast Properties that statements by an attorney to law enforcement on behalf of a client reporting a crime are qualifiedly privileged. Third, even if they don't meet qualified privilege, they still have to meet the definition of absolute privilege under Janklow v. Keller. And if you think that someone trying to make a false claim for compensation with victim's comp or a false claim of reporting a crime to Detective Balfe qualifies of meeting the purposes of the statute for absolute privilege, that's terrible. That's not the purpose of these statutes. You have to have the opportunity for good faith in there. And that's our argument. She may have a qualified privilege, but she abused it when she intentionally tried to get Kevin arrested 48 hours after the malicious prosecution trial and then tried to take advantage of the victim's comp procedures available. As it relates to Brooke Templeton, this one's a little closer for the simple reason it's not a report to law enforcement. That then goes to its legislative, judicial, or other official proceedings. I'm not convinced that proceeding in front of victims' comp is another official proceeding, but even if it is, I still don't think that she can meet the rigors of Janklow v. Keller. You know, Janklow v. Keller is good law. It was recently cited by this court, as recent as 2001, and you have to have four elements. The statement was made in the proceeding. The statement was not made in the proceeding. In fact, after she was denied compensation, she faxed off, which is her pattern, a note to the victim's comp and said, you got it wrong. Do I have to get more specific with you? Kevin did this. I'm this woman at home alone. I've been with my ex-husband for years, blah, blah, blah. You know, how you can say that's not direct? That's a jury question, by the way, on whether or not that's defamatory. That's a jury question. You know, it was not made in the proceeding. Number two, it had some connection to the action. Well, I suppose legitimately it had some connection to victim's comp because she was trying to make an allegation that somebody caused her harm. Number three, it was made to achieve the objects of the litigation. It was not. It was most certainly fraudulent. It had nothing to do with the legitimate objects of victim's compensation. And four, it involved litigants or other participants authorized by law. I suppose that theoretically you could say that it did because she had filed a petition and it was being requested for victim's comp. But let's step back 10,000 feet here. Do we really want to encourage people to submit defamatory and false documents with victims' comp and law enforcement? I think the public policy should be that we should have the opportunity to rebut those if they turn out to be made maliciously. No courtroom doors are going to be filled with people. It will be very few people. Thank you for the opportunity today, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Hosmer. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.